Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, January 11th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and we'll check in with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now, a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the island. Cindy, we saw data this week from the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office about its participation in an immigration program, essentially delivering some inmates with immigration violations to federal authorities. It's a program that raised a lot of concern when the sheriff's office said that it would be participating in it back in late 2017. What did we learn about how the program has worked over its first year?
Well, people who are opposed to it, like State Senator Julian Sear, who's a Democrat from Truro, said it hasn't, you know, lived up to the worst fears here. They have 79 inmates have been referred to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they have been people for hoping. Accused of pretty serious crimes, you know, from rape of a child with force to armed robbery. And Barnstable Sheriff James Cummings said that he's not going to refer people for having, you know, a broken headlight. This isn't something that he's going to use capriciously, that this is, you know, these are serious accusations of serious crimes.
And that was one of the big fears when this program was, when it was announced that the Sheriff's Department was going forward with this program. A lot of people were afraid that it could be used capriciously. It's a lot of power in the sheriff's office hands.
Right. And this is something that now Julian Sear said he's still not thrilled with the program. He doesn't think that local authorities should be having to fix a broken immigration system. He thinks this should still be in the hands of the federal government. But in the meantime, the sheriff said it seems to be working. He's happy with the way that the program is running. And that other crimes that they've been accused of are assault on a police officer, breaking and entering, operating under the influence, and drug trafficking. And sometimes they've been accused also of lesser crimes, but there's a felony attached to it. It's not just the lesser crime that they've been referred to ICE for. These are people who have been accused of committing felonies.
So these are people that are at the Barnstable County Jail, and then what happens to them in this process?
Well, they get entered in the system. Part of this partnership is that they can get into the ICE database, and then that effectively can start the deportation process, so that they can actually be then ICE can get involved. And ICE doesn't choose.
ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Right, and they don't choose to get involved with every case either. That James Cummings said that there have been some cases that they've said, no, we're not interested in this person or not interested in this case. And the people who have been referred, the 79 who have been referred, come from 26 different countries, mainly Jamaica, El Salvador, and Brazil.
And there's a season for all this, too. It sounds like there's a busier time of year for these authorities working that in August, I think, and through the summer, they were referring more people than through the rest of the year. There were some due process concerns. What were some of the concerns around this?
Well, some of the concerns are they are just, at this point, you know, they're accused. You know, they're not, you know, these people are not convicted, but they're, and the other thing is people have been referred in the past. But far fewer. In 2016 and 2017, the Barnstable Sheriff referred 15 inmates to ICE. But since starting the partnership, because they have access to this database, and he says there is an increased population of undocumented immigrants in the Cape, that has ramped up the numbers.
And I think there's also fear that among immigrant communities, if they're afraid to report crimes because they're afraid that they could be sort of sucked into this system and referred down to ICE. So having the sheriff sort of step forward and say it's only going to be for these felonies has been a way to address that.
Sear said he's concerned because he believes that other counties that have participated in it have used it, you know, more capriciously. And the other counties in Massachusetts are Bristol and Plymouth and the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. And they're the only agencies in New England that are cooperating with in this partnership with ICE. Now, because you were concerned, there's obviously concerns about things like domestic violence. Mm-hmm. You know, you want people to feel comfortable reporting these crimes and to having, you know, pursuing justice.
One of the critics here expressing some concern that all of these figures are essentially self-reported out of the sheriff's office.
Yes, the sheriff insists that there's transparency going on, but there's concerns among people people like Wayne Bergeron, who has expressed concern over this and wants to make sure the process is completely transparent and we know what's happening to people who are living here on the Cape and Islands who are being referred to ICE for possible deportation.
I think it's interesting to point out that Barnstable County is one of just three counties in Massachusetts that's participating. In fact, I think the only counties maybe in New England that are participating in this. It's Barnstable,
yes.
Plymouth, and Bristol are the three counties.
Right, exactly. And the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. But yeah, that's right. Those are the only three counties, not only Massachusetts, as you mentioned, but in New England.
What to do about sharks, Cindy McCormick? That's the question that towns have been asking ever since the fatal attack in Wellfleet last September. Now, a number of towns may be joining to fund a study of potential solutions. Tell us about this.
Well, it's interesting because salespeople have been flooding to the Cape Shores to demonstrate their drones and all these kind of devices that they say that will spot sharks, warn you about sharks. And it's like, okay, what's out there? What works the best? And what's most cost efficient? So the Woods Hole Group, which is based in Bourne, has submitted a proposal January 2nd to the Cape's Regional Shark Working Group. And that's for a $50,000 study of shark mitigation measures. And so this is, they're asking towns, Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet, Orleans, Chatham, and Eastham, along with the Cape Cod National Seashore and the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, to pony up just over $6,000 each to fund this study. And so this is supposed to look at like all the different alternatives, what will work the best, what can take place on this on a regional basis, and so people aren't duplicating efforts or spending extra money. And Chatham's pretty enthusiastic. Monday night, the Chatham selectmen unanimously voted to participate, and the Wellfleet town administrator Daniel Hort said that his town is interested too. His quote was, "We want to make sure there is scientific data to back up our decisions."
I guess for the towns, there's a little bit of a question about where the money to participate in this study is going to come from.
It's not a huge sum of money, but it's this every town has to contribute, as well as the seashore and the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. And some of the things that they're looking at are kind of interesting because they're looking at the drones and they're looking at maybe electronic and magnetic devices or bracelets that surfers and swimmers could wear. But the big question is, okay, this all sounds really good. It sounds like, but we want to know what works. I mean, do we go with a buoy, a shark detecting buoy? Do we go with a drone? Do we go with a drone that uses artificial intelligence? And so these are all the questions that they've had. This is, as you mentioned, this is especially on people's minds since 26-year-old Arthur Medici was killed in the Great White Attack at Newcomb Hollow Beach. That was September 15th.
Yeah.
And exactly 1 month before that, a Truro and swimmer was severely injured by a Great White shark. So these are things that are people, will it be safe to go into the ocean?
So this study is aimed at coming up with some regional approaches to solutions. And I guess the state has some money that may be put forward to this. But the idea is that if they have a study that sort of demonstrates what their path is to go forward, the state is more likely to help fund those solutions.
Right. And then one possible controversy with this study is that the public outreach will not occur until the later stages when they've come up with several proposed solutions and they're weighing the pros and cons of each. And a surfer told the Times, our paper, that the stakeholders and public really need to be included all along the way, that they have a lot to contribute to the discussion right from the very beginning.
We're going to speak right now with Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Holly.
Morning, Steve.
Holly, you've got a piece this week looking at the impact of vaping in the island schools. Explain for us what vaping is, just so that everyone knows, and then tell us a little bit about what's going on here and why it's concerning.
Yeah, so vaping is inhaling vaporized nicotine from an electronic cigarette, or basically just using an e-cigarette. And in 2015, a new type of e-cigarette came out, and it's called the Juul, J-U-U-L. And it's pretty small and discreet. It basically looks like a USB flash drive. And the creators of Juul say that, like other e-cigarettes, it's meant to help adults who already smoke by offering a healthier alternative to cigarettes. But Juul has been in the news a lot lately because what ended up happening, and some people attribute this to the company's glitzy early ad campaigns and their use of social media, what ended up happening was that young people, teenagers, adolescents across the country who never smoked cigarettes to begin with started using Juul, started Juuling. And it's become wildly popular, and now there's a lot of concern about youth nicotine addiction and the effect of nicotine on developing brains. So the Vineyard is no different. About 36% of high school students self-reported vaping in the last month. in a recent youth risk behavior survey, and the high school administration said they've had more than 14 suspensions just in the first semester for vaping, and that those suspensions are affecting some sports teams, too.
How is the school, what are they doing to try to cope with this?
Sure. They've recently launched a new health curriculum. It's called Catch My Breath, and it's specifically dedicated to the risks of vaping for young people and changing the perception of this behavior, because surveys show that kids just don't think that it's risky. But the CDC has put out guidance saying that they're concerned about the effects of nicotine aerosol on kids' lungs. They're nervous about the effect of nicotine on the developing brain, like I said, and they're also nervous about the effects of being addicted to a substance on young people. How does that change your behavior? Are you more anxious? Are you more aggressive? So school administrators say it's about changing the culture. It's about making sure that there's a perception of risk, and they also recognize that this is an addiction problem. So if you're caught vaping, they try and connect kids with recovery coaches, they try and connect their parents with the school nurse and with medical professionals. And they just said the most important thing is making sure that kids understand that there are long-term consequences to what you're doing now and the decisions that you're making now.
Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. Holly, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, the future of a real landmark of the Lower Cape art scene is in question. This is the Monomoy Theater. Tell us what's happening here.
Sure. For those who may not be familiar with Monomoy Theater, it's located on Main Street in Chatham. It's been a summer theater here since 1938. From 1958 to 2014, it was operated by the University of Ohio University. And since then, the University of Hartford has been the sponsor of it. You know, it's kind of like a summer boot camp for theater students. They all live on the property. They work together pretty much 24/7. They put on 8 shows over a 10-week season. It's a real learning experience for these kids. But last summer, town inspectors found numerous violations of health and safety codes in the living spaces at the theater. And those violations, they say, have to be taken care of before they'll allow the buildings to be occupied again this coming season. And there was uncertainty over who was responsible for making those repairs between the University of Hartford, which holds the lease on the property, and the property's owners, which is the Steindler family. Because of that uncertainty, the university opted not to exercise an option to renew its lease, which expires on March 15th. And because of that, the Steindler family trust decided that they had to, without a tenant, they had to put the property, which is nearly 4 acres, on the market. And that sort of has thrown in doubt whether there will actually be a summer season this year at Monomoy. Now, the trust has held some discussions with a nonprofit group called Monomoy Theater, Inc., which formed a few years ago. And they are interested in purchasing the property and continuing to operate it as it always has. The trust includes many people who have been involved in the theaters for decades, including artistic director Alan Rust, who actually runs a theater program at the Hart School at University of Hartford. But at this point, neither side would give any details about the purchase price or where they are at with discussions right now. A spokesperson for the trust said that they're planning to put the property on the open market in about 3 weeks, and at that point, the sale price will obviously be known. And if any agreement can be reached for the nonprofit group to acquire the property, they say that they are prepared to go ahead with fundraising and apply for state, federal, and local grants to support both the purchase and the renovation of the property. Now the theater has a lot of support in town, and it's pretty from our investigations and just talking to folks around town, this is very doable for this nonprofit group to buy the property, which has an assessed value from the town of about 1.9 million. You know, this is a very visible, important property. It's right near the downtown area. The there's historic buildings on the property, both the theater, which used, at one point was a toy factory, dates to the late 1800s. There's also a very interesting double Greek Revival house on the property, which fronts on Main Street, which people know is quite a landmark. But the buildings are in rough shape. They need work. And it's at this point where we're hoping that the trust and the nonprofit group can get together and that the property doesn't have to go out on the open market, because then sort of all bets are off about mm-hmm. what could happen with it.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for that.
Thank you, Steve.
Cindy McCormick is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, the parking lot at Herring Cove Beach is going to be rebuilt. This has been a long time coming, and now there's word that it will be built further inland than originally proposed.
Yeah, this is one of the most popular of the Cape Cod National Seashore beaches and draws a lot of tourists to the area who end up in Provincetown later in the day and contributes to the health, economic health of the region. But yeah, there have been plans long in the works to rebuild a parking lot in the north. That's the parking lot we can drive right up to the water's edge there, and people love that. That part of the parking lot. But there's been a lot of erosion. They're calling it hotspot erosion, so they've had to adjust their plans. And last month, the Provincetown Conservation Commission approved seashore plans to move to rebuild it further inland, 50 feet inland, as a matter of fact.
This is a big project. It's got a big price tag.
Yeah, this is a $3.3 million price tag, and it's all and people hope it gets done as soon as possible. The project was supposed to start off; it did start off October 17th, and but there was no there's been a federal shutdown. There were no signs of any. Our reporter did not see any signs of work going on when she went out there. January 2nd or so, and but it's supposed to be, there's a sign saying it's supposed to be done by spring, which will make the people who own businesses in Provincetown happy and make the tourists happy.
The park has been, National Park there has been working hard to keep this old lot open throughout the time that it's needed repairs, and it's been a costly endeavor.
Yes. Well, what they've been doing all along is sort of making repairs every year. It's just sort of a piecemeal type of situation, because the past 10 years, there's been a lot of winter storms that torn up the pavement, loosened a seawall. And what's happening now, they say, is that this the beach there is assuming its natural contours with all the damage to the seawall. And this is a temporary problem, but they've been making these piecemeal solutions. But now the seashore are saying that with this big improvement, that it should last for 20 years. So they're hoping that they won't have to make these little piecemeal construction efforts every year.
And as you point out, the parking here isn't just important to the town for the beach, but the parking is such a commodity in Provincetown.
Yes, and the Provincetown Tourism Director, Anthony Fucello, said that visitors often start the trip to Provincetown at the beach, and then they end up in town later in the day, and this won't happen if the parking is not available.
And along with the parking lot, they're also moving one of the roads out there, the Province Lands Road.
Yeah, they're moving the Province Lands Roads inland also. So this is because they're just otherwise they're afraid it'll be washed away. And they're saying that this hotspot erosion is stemming from condition at Hatches Harbor to the north. And so that, but it's affecting the parking lot area. And they do believe it's a temporary thing, that this will abate after a while. But in the meantime, they have to take care of this erosion.
And the new parking lot, they're hoping is going to last for about how, do they have an idea how long that
could
be?
Well, 20 years, they're saying that, yeah, they're saying. And the southernmost lot is much more protected. It's farther inland already, and it's protected. But the northern lot is very popular with people who like to, well, first of all, it provides 208 parking spaces.
Yeah.
And then it's also popular with people who like to just drive up right to the water's edge.
Cindy, the state has passed a new law taxing short-term rentals like Airbnbs. Advocates have been pushing for this for a while. Now it's become law. There are still a number of questions about how it's going to work.
Yeah, realtors say that people don't really know how to apply this, how to pay it, you know, what the regulations are, what the forms are, whether town meeting has to pass, you know, a new requirement mm-hmm. for this tax. And the Department of Revenue has not really come up with a lot of information. They're saying, the DOR is saying kind of stay tuned and see what happens next.
And you can imagine with all the properties here, the summer rental properties, everybody, so many people leaning forward wondering what this is going to be. and what it's going to look like.
Right. And it's, and the towns are starting registries, and they're charging people fees for participating in the registries, different types of fees. And Provincetown, it's interesting. When it started its registry in 2015, they initially had 587 properties listed. That jumped by 20% in 2016. That's according to Stephen Lorello. He's a part-time co-compliance officer for Provincetown, whose position is funded by the $300 registry fee. I think that's $300 for 3 years.
For 3 years, I think, right. Yes. This new short-term rental tax is, as Massachusetts, it turns out, is, I think, the last state in New England to adopt this kind of a tax.
Yes, yes. And this is for rentals that are for properties that are rented out for more than 2 weeks a season for terms shorter than 31 days. So we're talking about Airbnbs and, you know, your private rentals and all the different programs that are out there now where so many private property owners are renting out rooms in their homes.
A portion of this tax is earmarked also to help with wastewater issues across the Cape. That's been something we've been looking for a while, a lot of people.
Yeah, that's 2.7% is dedicated to water pollution projects, and that's and Andrew Gottlieb is the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. He said, I think that's one of the most important pieces of environmental legislation in a generation on the Cape. So that's, of course, obviously, water pollution abatement efforts are very crucial to our economy and our environment. So he's thrilled with that part of it.
It does seem like a complicated tax. I was looking at Doug Fraser's article on this, and there's a number of different pieces or components of it. There's a 5.7% state tax here, and then different local taxes come in as well as it's going along.
Yeah, it's called a suite of taxes or layered approach to taxes, and people aren't quite sure yet what it's going to, what the total tax bill is going to be.
It's 5%, 5.7% state tax goes directly to the state's general fund, a 4-6% local tax that goes back to the towns, then a 2.75% surcharge that goes into the wastewater protection fund, and then there's maybe even an optional
3% impact fee for towns, which 35% is required to go to affordable housing and or infrastructure projects. So there is a lot of money to be dispersed here and going to different funds and town and municipal government agencies, government, the state, local.
Different local projects,
right.
Too, yes. We're going to speak right now with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, the new Nantucket Cottage Hospital was originally scheduled to open next week, and now that's been pushed back some. Bring us up to date here.
It has. Hospital officials are eyeing a mid-February opening now for the new $90 million healthcare facility that's being built right next to the existing hospital in the middle of the island between Prospect Street and Vestura Lane. Hospital President and CEO Margot Hartman said the short delay is due primarily to making sure that improvements and adjustments are made to the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems in the new building, and that some equipment, which might not get here on time, is in and everything is up and running the way it's supposed to be before they welcome their first patients. With a project of this magnitude, an extra month or so, really not that much of a delay at all, and it looks like the hospital is on schedule to open this winter, and the new hospital will be open. The old one will be coming down. They have to do some asbestos remediation. Then they can begin demolishing the current building, which was built in 1957. And in its place, they'll finish up the project with some landscaping and some additional parking. The new hospital is about 106,000 square feet in size. That's compared to about 65,000 square feet of the current hospital. Again, that's more than 60 years old. And the new hospital, obviously, state-of-the-art, meeting the state and federal standards for size and for healthcare requirements that simply by virtue of it being more than 60 years old, the current hospital cannot. Everybody looks sort of looking forward to that. A lot of new innovations that have come along in healthcare in recent years in terms of where patients go, where doctors go, those are all being incorporated into this new building. The larger building, there's going to be more exam rooms in the new hospital. There's going to be an extra operating suite. There's only one in the current hospital. There's going to be two in the new hospital. All the primary care doctors, except for one, will be located in a centralized location in the new hospital. The old hospital, they were spread around a little bit, both in the main building and outside. The emergency department, where the bulk of the hospital's activity takes place year-round, is almost going to be twice as large. There's going to be 12 exam rooms compared to 7 currently. So a much bigger hospital, much bigger facility. It's something that's been in the works and in the planning stages for a long time and finally coming to fruition within the next month or so.
And the new building built to withstand a hurricane, a powerful hurricane.
built to withstand a powerful hurricane, like most of the new buildings out here, you know, like our police station, our fire station, our new schools, Nantucket, being where we are, has to have a strong buildings, and the new hospital will be one of those. And the hospital has long been a place where the community has been sort of invited to gather in the event of some major catastrophe of Mother Nature, that kind of thing. They keep the power on there, obviously, for their patients and their doctors. And you know, regardless of what the weather is, there have been blizzards and nor'easters and hurricanes in the past where very little is operating on the island, but the hospital remains up and running.
A couple notable changes at two major conservation groups on the island. What's happening here?
The Nantucket Land Council and the Nantucket Conservation Foundation are the two groups we're talking about. The Land Council has chosen one of its own to be its new executive director. The environmental advocacy organization this week promoted its longtime resource ecologist, Emily Molden, to replace Cormac Collier, who's leaving in April to become president and CEO of the Conservation Foundation. The Land Council is more than 40 years old, and it's really the advocacy arm of environmental protection on the island. It works to protect open space through public advocacy, legal challenges, does a lot of scientific research, and administers conservation restrictions. And the Conservation Foundation controls about 9,000 acres of open space on the island, the vast, vast majority of it open to the public. And Cormac Collier, who's been with the Land Council for more than 15 years, is going over to the foundation, and Emily Molden, who's been with the council for about the same amount of time, is going to be stepping into his shoes. They've worked closely together. They decided to stay in-house. They said she was the perfect candidate for the job, much like the Conservation Foundation, after they did a nationwide year-long search for a new leader, stayed on the island, didn't stay in-house, but stayed on the island and tapped Cormac Collier to be their new leader as they head into further into the 21st century.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick is with me from the Cape Cod Times, and on the phone with us right now is Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. Great to see you at the CAI Pub Night in Wellfleet on Wednesday.
That was a great evening. Thanks for coming out. Ed, the Provincetown Harbor Master has been suspended for a number of days without pay. What's happening here?
Well, we're talking about the management and operation of McMillan Pier, which is the town-owned pier, the major harbor facility in Provincetown, obviously a really important part of the town's economy and ambience. And the town created the Provincetown Public Pier Corporation some years ago to be in charge of managing the pier. And this is so it has a board of directors of five people who are appointed by the selectmen. And they employ the pier manager and harbor master, who is Rex McKinsey. And there have been some issues over the last few years, really, with relations between McKinsey and the Pier Corporation board, where they haven't always been happy with his financial management. And it came to a head last week at the Pier Corporation's meeting when it emerged that McKinsey had submitted a budget to the town, even though his salary is paid by the Pier Corporation, which maintains its own finances. The Harbor Master's office is funded by the town and is part of the regular budget that gets approved every year at town meeting. And the board of the Pier Corporation had a discussion about how much they should request for next year and decided that they wanted to ask for $256,000 in that line for the Harbor Master's expenses. And then they found out, after they took a vote on it, that McKinsey had already submitted the budget request asking for $204,000, mm-hmm. considerably less than the board wanted. And this really ticked them off, to say the least. And they decided at their meeting last week that McKinsey needed to be not just reprimanded, but really disciplined. Board member Carlos Verdi offered five six actually different possible options for the board to take, ranging from no action to termination of McKinsey. And they voted 3-1 with one member absent to take the second most serious actions in the list, which was to suspend him for 5 days without pay. Mm-hmm. Now, McKinsey, for his part, didn't really want to comment on the whole budget question. He, under questioning by our reporter, said that he had mentioned, in fact, that he had submitted the budget already, but that it wasn't heard, he said. Verdi was very much more outspoken, saying, you had three different opportunities to tell us about the budget, and you failed to tell us. So, and there have been other issues as well with McKinsey spending money on things that the board really didn't know about and didn't really approve of.
So now, I'm going to jump in here. So now McKinsey is facing, what, 5 days suspension without pay?
That's right. The board didn't decide exactly which days or when this suspension would take place. They have to figure out, like, who's going to be an interim peer manager while McKinsey is suspended, and they don't really have anyone lined up to do that yet. So they're still working on that. It's going to cost McKinsey, he said, about $1,100. And he said, I already don't make a whole lot. So he's not happy with that. And our reporter also tells us that the town manager's office, David Panagor, is not too happy with the board's decision. There's more coming, obviously, on this whole issue, and there needs to be some better procedures, apparently, set up for budgeting and managing the finances of the pier.
Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. On the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is Brian Dowd. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Brian, we talked a little earlier in the program about the new short-term rental tax on the island. There's a new group that would like to see a portion of that tax go toward affordable housing.
Yeah, so this new housing group on the island is trying to harness the momentum of that short-term rental tax bill that Governor Baker signed at the end of the year. And it's called the Martha's Vineyard Housing Bank. And it essentially would just be a bank where a portion of that rental tax bill that towns are receiving would come back, go to this bank, and be used for affordable housing projects on the island. The housing bank is an extension of the Citizens Committee, which is a group that formed a couple of years ago, and they went around to island towns and asked voters at annual town meeting if they thought a housing bank would be a good idea. And this was a non-binding question, but they got an overwhelming response with about 70% of island voters in five of the six island towns saying that they would want a housing bank.
Does it look like what has to happen for this tax to a portion of the proceeds to go to this housing bank?
So right now they're calling themselves the Housing Bank campaign. They're going around to island towns and they're trying to get a question on the upcoming annual town meetings that would essentially let voters officially decide if they want it, and then they would need a state legislative approval. But it would give them a portion of that new revenue. So towns can put an up to 6% tax on these short-term rentals, which would include Airbnb rentals, VRBO rentals, but also hotels and motels. And towns can put an up to 6% tax, but the housing bank is asking just for 3%, so half of that.
Brian, I want to ask you about another story. Last week, we talked about the first baby of the new year born on the island. It was kind of a wild story that ended happily. This week, one of the key figures in that story celebrated a different kind of happy landmark. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so Ben Rettmeyer, who was in the ambulance helping with that New Year's baby, has had quite the week, and he got married last Friday to Elise Spinell, and it was definitely the coolest wedding on the vineyard. They are both huge hockey fans, and they grew up playing hockey, and they teach youth hockey today, and so they got married on the ice at the Martha's Vineyard ice arena, and Rettmeyer is now his wife, Elise. Her father got a one-day license to marry them. All their friends came out. They went all in on the hockey theme. Instead of, you know, suits and gowns and dresses, they had specially made hockey jerseys, black for the groom and the groomsmen and white for the bride and her bridesmaids.
Very nice. Very nice. Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station is scheduled to shut down before June of this year. There are a lot of questions still out there about how this will work, and the public had a chance to ask them earlier this week.
Yeah, that was on Tuesday. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission held a webinar, and area residents participated. Some of the things they wanted to know was how the federal agency is going to guarantee that that Pilgrim's decommissioning trust fund will be enough to cover the costs. The trust fund currently stands at $1.05
billion. And this webinar allowed people to ask questions. What other things are people concerned about?
Well, they're concerned about the environment around the area. Duxbury resident Mary Lambert, who is the director of Pilgrim Watch, requested a major study of the site under the National Environmental Policy Act. The last review was 2002. And Lambert had some strong words. She said she knows that there have been leaks and illegally buried hazardous waste around the property. But Bruce Watson, who's the chief of the NRC's reactor decommissioning branch, said no such study was required. He also said whichever company does the decommissioning is responsible for the funds. And at this point, the owner of Pilgrim Energy wants to hand off the plant, which is scheduled to close by June 1st, to a company called Holtec International.
And they would do the decommissioning.
Yeah, and Holtec plans to make quick work of it. They want to dismantle and dispose of the buildings and equipment and clean up the site within 8 years of the shutdown. And that would be for a price tag of $1.13 billion. But first, Energy has to transfer the license, and that could take up to a year. And there's also the possibility that the NRC could deny the license. Mm-hmm. So Entergy had to come up with its own plan for decommissioning, and that was quite different.
Not quite the same timeline. Tell us about this.
Oh, no, plan. No. They would mothball the operations, in essence, for 50 years, and they would drain the systems and shut down the electrical functions that would no longer be needed. This is an option called Safe Store. And Entergy is saying that this length of time would reduce the level of radioactivity in the buildings and also allow the plant trust fund to grow, because they're estimating the cost is going to be $1.66 billion to pursue that option. And under that plan, the plant would not be decommissioned until 2079.
Yes. So I guess there's some concern about the money that this is going to cost if the license does get transferred to this company, Holtec, to decommission the plant. What if they run out of money, or what if even Entergy runs out of money before this thing gets decommissioned? Who's on the hook for that?
Well, Bruce Watson from the NRC said that those companies are on the hook for that, that they're responsible for the costs. And even though they're like limited liability companies that would be handling this, that their liability is not limited. And so that he was trying to assure people that this would happen and that the costs would be there and the companies would be liable for it. People were also concerned about the possible elimination of emergency planning protection for mm-hmm. people who live in the area. If it's shut down, but it still has radioactivity on the site, so people still want to know that they are going to be – that this will be part of an emergency plan in case anything does happen during the shutdown and the decommissioning process.
So a lot of questions still out there. There is going to be a public forum on this where folks can go and ask questions. It's next Tuesday at 6 p.m. in Plymouth at the Hotel 1620. So you can find information about that online. In December, the towns of Dennis and Yarmouth held an election about whether to fund a new regional middle school. Dennis voted in favor, Yarmouth against, but the overall decision was in favor by just a small number of votes. Now Yarmouth is looking at options for trying to get out of this project.
Yeah, this election was very narrowly approved. This was 32 votes in total.
And yesterday they did a recount in the Dennis side, and they lost 3 votes out of the approval. So it's down to 29 votes.
Right, because Dennis voters had okayed it by 60% in the original district-wide election, but more than a majority of Yarmouth voters rejected it. That was 56%. Mm-hmm. And so Yarmouth officials are saying, no, this isn't fair, and they're considering a possible lawsuit injunction to stop the construction of this new middle school. This would be a DY middle school. Currently, they have 2 middle schools, one's in Dennis and one's in Yarmouth. This would be a joint school, and it would be located in Yarmouth, and the cost would be $117 million, $44 million from the state. They'd be eligible for $44 million from the state. But Yarmouth is unhappy for one thing about the share of the cost. They have the larger student population, and they'd be on the hook for a bigger share of the cost in Dennis, where the population is actually declining.
And I guess as Yarmouth is looking to possibly initiate some legal action to try to get out of this, one question they have is the process by which the towns were asked to approve the project and the accompanying debt.
Yeah, because they're saying, you know, the regional agreement, that this should have gone to town meeting. Each town should have had to vote to approve this. And they're saying that this is according to a state statute about regional school district agreements. However, the school committee said that they looked at another part of that same statute, and there is another possibility where they could just go to a district-wide vote, which is what they did. However, the Yarmouth officials are saying, wait a second, this district-wide vote is normally used when it's really big regional school district. For instance, Cape Tech approving their new building. They've got 12 member towns, and they went to the district-wide approach. But they said, yeah, you don't want one town to, you know, hold up the entire process for when you have, you know, a big school district like that. But they're saying, Yarmouth officials are saying, show us where a two-member district has ever pursued the district-wide vote before.
Yeah. But it sounds like their legal counsel is uncertain whether that argument is going to hold any water. That really, it doesn't look so great.
Yeah, they talked with Jason Tellerman for over an hour this week, but he said it's not a sure thing, but he said he's willing to try the argument if that's what the majority of the Board of Selectmen want. The school committee would be a defendant. The town would also need an injunction to stop the work from proceeding.
The Trump administration has said it would like to open federal offshore waters to exploration and drilling for oil and gas. One local lawmaker is joining others from around the country in an effort to block this.
Yeah, this was State Representative Dylan Fernandez, a Democrat from Woods Hole. He joined lawmakers from across the country Tuesday, and they announced plans to file legislation that would ban offshore drilling in their state's waters. These are legislators from Connecticut, Georgia, Hawaii, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, Oregon, and Rhode Island. And this was all on a conference call.
And it's kind of interesting because offshore drilling and exploration for oil and gas, it's not a state issue. It's a federal issue, and state waters just go out 3 miles. So how are they looking to make this work?
Well, the state waters only go out 3 miles out to sea, but these drilling bans, when they would span contiguous coastal states, it would this create this sort of infrastructure blockade. So it would make the cost of going out into the federal waters beyond that, had to jump over this wall, so to speak, making projects cost prohibitive for developers.
So if all the states along the East Coast or the Northeast had this ban in their local waters, that would be enough to make it a financial obstacle to any company looking to pursue that in federal waters offshore.
Right. And I mean, and the other Atlantic states, New Jersey was the first state to have a ban on offshore drilling within the state waters. That was last year. It was followed by Delaware, Maryland, and then California and Florida. But so you see, we would have this blockade effect going down the eastern seaboard here.
And the concern now with the oil and gas exploration and drilling is that it could damage our coastal ecosystems.
Yeah, Fernandez said that the ban is necessary. It's to preserve the state and region's vibrant blue economy. There is tourism, the fishing industries. If there were, it could be devastated by offshore drilling if there was an accident or an oil spill.
That kind of brings us to the next story I want to talk about, which is you covered this story for the Cape Cod Times. As a matter of fact, it has to do with the so-called blue economy, and it was a career showcase held this week for young people.
Yeah, this was about 300 students from the from Cape Cod and the islands. This was at Cape Cod Community College, and it was called a Waterworks event, and it was to expose students to all these different careers in our blue economy. And it's quite diverse. It's for students. I mean, it's for students who would think of they might want to pursue a degree in marine biology. They might want to get their PhD. And the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution was there, and other scientific institutions were there. But it's also it was appealing to high school students who might be going to work directly after high school. There was a fisherman there taking the names of kids who might want to work on, you know, fishing boats, and there were there's also the state environmental police there. There were and natural resources officers, and it just kind of opened your eyes to how many jobs there are that are related to the sea, and, you know, boat engine sales and boat building. And there's just it made you realize that our economy really does revolve around the ocean to a large extent.
One of the things you pointed out in your article, which I thought was interesting, is that there are entry levels for kids all along. You can come out of high school and enter the blue economy. You can go to college and come out. You can go to graduate school and come out and enter the blue economy.
Right. And the Steamship Authority was there, and I was talking to someone from the Steamship Authority's personnel department, and he was saying that all of their captains actually come up through the ranks there. And you start as an able-bodied seaman, and you have to – that's a Coast Guard certification. And even if you're in high school and you want to work during the summer, for certain jobs – not all jobs, but for certain jobs, you need that certification. So people start out cleaning toilets, and then they can rise to become a captain. And it's, yeah, so there's and one of the fishermen I talked to said that he wished that he had known earlier about the jobs in the fishing industry, because he wouldn't have spent as much time in the service economy as he did.
Now, Cape Cod Community College has received a very welcome gift, and this follows a little bit on the Waterworks Career Day that we've just been talking about.
Yes, this is the largest gift in their 58-year history. It was $5 million, and it was a gift from Maureen Wilkins. And this is for their new science and engineering building that will be a state-of-the-art facility. Now, the Wilkins, she and her late husband Frank, are already major benefactors for the college. The college library is named after them, and they've helped with scholarships. One of their first gifts helped pay for a young single mother who is trying to afford a higher education.
And so this is a substantial gift, $5 million, and they've been longtime supporters of the college, the Wilkins family.
Right, and more recently, they helped pay for the renovation of the college's nursing lab. Now, this science and engineering building, the estimated cost is $38 million, of which $25 million is included in a bond bill signed by Governor Charlie Baker last year. The building is expected to be complete by 2022, and the college is contributing $3 million. Now, they foresee Educational Foundation started a capital campaign for additional funds.
There's no design yet for this building, but it's obviously an exciting opportunity for the college, and you think about what it's going to mean to their science and engineering program there.
Right. And Maureen Wilkins was saying that students and faculty deserve a modern state-of-the-art facility, and she called the community college a hidden gem. Now, Kathy McNamara, who is CEO of the College Educational Foundation, said that this is an unusual gift for a community college. She said typically community colleges don't get gifts of this size, and she said it puts the college more than puts her organization more than halfway to the college fundraising goal of $10 million. And it was actually Wilkins was going to give a smaller amount, but she increased her share after learning that the amount of funding from the state was not as much as it anticipated.
Cindy, let me ask you about what you're working on. What do you have coming out over the weekend?
Well, I have actually a story about vaping and the high schools and the problem with vaping. And as student smoking has gone way down, I mean, actually burning your regular cigarette, but vaping has taken off in the past 3 years, and even in the past 2 years, it's huge. And students, it's a very hard thing to detect because there is no actual smoke. There might be just a little vapor trail or a fruity scent. And this is, I've talked to school administrators, a doctor, and a county official who said this is an attempt on the part of the tobacco industry to capture this youth crowd again, because they have the fruity flavors, pina colada flavors, you know, kind of like what you might consider sicklingly sweet flavors. But this appeals to younger students, not all of whom realize that most of these products contain nicotine. And they can also contain THC. People can rework their jewels or their devices to have illicit substances in them. So this is a real concern for schools.
We'll be looking for that in the Cape Cod Times. That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick. Cindy, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
And we heard from Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Checked in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.